Hello and welcome to another episode of Transformational Blueprints, where we try to put a dent in the large number of transformation programs that fail. Hosted by me, Mario Michaels, founder and director of Synaxia Group. On this series, we will bring you unique insights drawn from first-hand experience from some of the most high-profile architecture and transformation leaders across the globe. Topics told in order to share knowledge, experiences, and ideas to inspire, innovate, and give back to the architecture community. So grab a coffee, sit back, and relax. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Transformational Blueprint. Today, we're going to be talking to Chris Perks about how we connect architecture to the wider business. Chris Perks is an enterprise architect and author with over a decade of experience in IT architecture roles. Trained initially as an engineer, he's worked on strategic initiatives for a number of large companies in banking, building services, consumer goods, and more recently, retail. Based in the Northwest, and he tried, like everybody, to balance work with life, cycling, music, and creative writing. Which, Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mario.
I think probably a great place to start, Chris, is tell us a little bit about being an author. What's that?
Well, I've never turned down an opportunity to plug a book, but I wrote my novel, 38, a decade ago now. Somewhat extent inspired by the events of the time, which I thought had parallels with the 1930s, and now has become scarily true given the unfolding events in Russia and elsewhere. So, yeah, it's a story set in the late 30s. It involves somebody who's working in technology, the steam railways, rather than high tech as we do. Yeah, it plays with some of the themes around that. A little bit of me coming out in there. Mm-hmm. An opportunity for me to find a creative outlet outside of the IT world.
And who, if you're listening to this podcast, who would you say, right, this book, you should absolutely read it? Obviously, you're the author, so you're going to say everybody, but...
If like a little bit of a mystery, then there's a sense of mystery around there. There's a sense of wonder at science and the technology and playing around with that. If you're interested in political ideas, without getting too heady into mm-hmm. that, I think there's something in it for you there. So, yeah, statesmen, steam trains, refugees and revolutionaries all share their stage, I think, is what I wrote in the blurb. So, yeah.
Great. What's it called again, Chris?
38, available on Amazon and other bookstores.
Great stuff. Right, we'll have to look into that then. Well, look, once again, thanks for joining the podcast. A good place to start is tell us a bit of background about yourself. How did you get to where you are now and so on?
So I started out as an engineer. So I studied chemical engineering at university, came out mid-90s, and realized that all the really exciting jobs were actually in information technology. Spent some time working my way up from very hands-on roles through into architecture roles. My first architecture role proper was back in 2005 or thereabouts. Moved from the purely technical architecture through solution architecture with an increasing focus on business processes, contact with and understanding business. And I think one of the things that I'm keen to talk to you about is how having that contact with the business is so important to informing architecture.
Absolutely. And we'll absolutely come on to that. So give us, in terms of, and we'll come on to sort of more details about your sort of career later on, but in your opinion, what do you think makes a great architect in today's world, whether that's cheap, solution, technical application, whatever it may be?
I think having an appreciation for technology is obviously the starting point. So if you're enthusiastic for technology and what technology can do for the company you work in and the wider world, that's obviously the most useful starting point. The clue is in the name around architecture. We're thinking in terms of design. So it's really, we're thinking just about shoving technology in for the sake of it, but thinking about the design of it, the reusability of it. But what I've increasingly come to realize is actually the really important thing is it's answering the question. So if we're not just doing technology for the sake of it, what is it we're trying to solve? What are we trying to achieve? And always being mindful of that. So some people who can think about that will be successful in architecture roles.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there's a big drive now when businesses are recruiting. Obviously, I'm from a talent perspective, help businesses find architects around the softer skills, because as you say, it's about answering the question. And sometimes you've got to be able to ask the right question or line of questioning to be able to solve the solution. And, you know, historically, sometimes architects have been really, really technical and personality-wise, again, we'll come on to this in a bit, personality-wise may not suit exactly what an architect should be doing and so on. So, okay, so today's pod is all around connecting architecture to the business, to the wider business, not just technology, but using, having technology as an appreciation and using technology as an enabler, which I think every single company wants to do and say they are doing, but in reality, they're probably not. It's probably a technology architect role purely focused on technology rather than wider business. How do you go about aligning architecture or an architecture practice to the wider business?
I think it's about conversations. So the most important skill an architect or indeed any other technologist can bring is the ability to have those conversations and be informed by them. It's important to ask questions indeed and to ask the follow-up question, you know, just run that by me again. How does that work? What happens if this does? And in particular, if you don't understand, it's really important that you keep asking the questions until you do understand. So don't be afraid to expose the limits of your own knowledge by the questioning that you're using. The other important thing is making sure you listen to the answer, because somebody will then play back what they are used to saying. Does that make sense to you? Does it actually expose the thing that you were digging into? Or are you actually finding that there's sort of prevarication, you know, they're confabulating, they're making noise when there's not actually something to convey there? And politely trying to steer the conversation back onto the very specific points.
Okay. And so you're saying basically start with the stakeholder in mind and across the whole business rather than technology and moving it back to front.
So the important thing is understanding your stakeholders and who they are. Certainly colleagues in technology teams are important to them. Mm-hmm. And it's important that you build up good relationships with them, whether they're developers or engineers or analysts or managers. But having relationships out with the business and the wider business and the stakeholders. So that could be senior members of the team, but equally could be people right at the chalk face of the business, at where the work is going on, and understanding the points of friction perhaps for them, or understanding what their own aspirations and how they would like to see the business evolve, and realizing that potentially with technology or other changes.
And that must be really hard to do, because I suppose, you know, that the more stakeholders you're speaking to and the more understanding of the business you're getting, the higher up of type of person that you are speaking to, potentially. But I suppose, you know, architects, especially enterprise and chief architect, some get a really bad reputation as a practice, as a job, for being an ivory tower architect. And I suppose if you are out there speaking at a really, really high level all the time, how do you distinguish between not being an ivory tower architect, but still being at the right level, but not getting into the detail because you want your team to be into the detail? How do you distinguish those parameters, I suppose?
So some of the concepts in architecture can be rather dry. So the TOGAF or document framework, so very theoretical, got a lot of documentation that sits around them. But they're useful as a framework for thinking. And I think if you don't think of them as unnecessarily restrictive, but rather informing how you approach this, whether it's an iterative approach to architecture, or whether it's the importance of documentation, not just from a purely technical point of view, but documentation that covers the entirety of the enterprise. If you recognize some of the innate truths in those, but don't get hung up on them, and don't use those as excellent reasons not to do something.
Yes.
Get involved in those conversations. So when you're having those conversations, whether they're with somebody, you know, on the shop floor, or whether they're somebody in the boardroom, as long as you're a human being and talking in the sorts of terms you or I might be talking now, rather than in the, well, let me bring this back to this particular framework and let me ask this particular stilted question, that's never going to work. But if you empathize, you sympathize, you understand why it's the way it is, understand the history, give people time perhaps to expand on their own experience there, and also have the filters there. Sometimes there will be extraneous stuff that you don't need to hear, but spend time with that. Building up those relationships, I think, is important, because then when you get back to the office or you get back to your desk and you're thinking this through and it doesn't make sense, just going back to them and saying, it's perhaps the Columbo moment.
Yeah.
This thing that doesn't quite make sense, could you outline it to me? They've not got their guard up. They know that you're a human being. You know what? It's a continuing conversation that we're having.
And over the past sort of few years, as we've worked together and got to know each other better, you've always said how I brought up the point, I can't remember when it was, around how, you know, you should treat your internal stakeholders as clients, because a lot of architects do, you know, we've got to keep them happy and so on and so forth. But actually, when we had discussion a few days ago, you mentioned that actually they shouldn't be called a client, but they should actually obviously be called a stakeholder. But why? Why do you believe that?
Well, my take on client is it means in my mind something quite transactional. So I'm thinking client. I had some time in as a service provider, for example. Clients were very specifically the people who paid the bills, the people people we were pitching business to. And it could feel like a very transactional relationship. Where my architecture career has succeeded, it's by not having those transactional relationships, but having those conversations, whether in the corridor, whether having a cup of tea, or whether just sitting down at somebody's desk and letting them unburden themselves with what's frustrating them or where they'd like to go, what their ambitions are. Those sorts of conversations are the really important ones to me. And so I think everybody has a stake in this, hence a stakeholder. Everybody has moving on the business they're working in, because they want to make, you know, the world a better place. They would like to be successful in their role. Perhaps they'd like to aspire to a different role, but there are things that they would need to do to build those. So everybody has a stake. I think stakeholder covers it. I wouldn't get hung up on terminology. If people want to use client, then I don't think we'll fall out, Mario.
And I suppose the reason where that comes from is because historically IT or technology department has always been seen as a cost center, and actually architecture is probably more so, because, you know, it's really hard to really put a tangible value on architecture. So, but it's unfortunate, but it's the reality. How do you, when you are in your roles as a, whether it's an enterprise architect or head of architecture, how do you demonstrate the return on investment to the wider business?
I think it would be very difficult to do a sort of chargeback model with an architecture function. So it'd be very difficult to do that. We do have the concept of asking for early engagement with our business. And it's important that people feel that they can come to us early on and ask our opinion, and we can give that freely. So there is the concept of the T-shirt sizing or the initial input assessment, which you get for free out of architecture. There's some architects do, which is far more involved and requires often many weeks of work around high level designs. And those we would be very keen to tie in with wider governance within a company. So, for example, we're not working on heavy duty high level designs unless a project initiation has taken place, unless there's a wide head of steam behind that piece of work. But in terms of how do we demonstrate the value of architecture, I think it's really by being involved from the very beginning in terms of shaping that demand. What architecture can do is it can round off the edges, it can refine, it can shape, it can help somebody envisage what this is going to be. So somebody will often come to you with a problem saying, I have a solution to it. I want to buy this particular piece of software shelf. Okay, well, that's great. But what analysis have you done to bring yourself to the conclusion that it's this particular piece of software in counterpoint to every other one? Another extreme is people come to you with a concept that they want to achieve, but they won't have an idea of they might technically achieve that. And we can also help shape that, can envisage what it do, how it would work. We can have a to and fro, a dialogue of ideas about what that might look like, what the answer to the possible is, what might be the answer to the possible in, you know, 6 or 12 months time, depending on technology roadmaps. So I think that's my point is you demonstrate the value by getting involved early on, you demonstrate the value by delivering on the conversations. It's more than just a talking topic. It comes, here is something we tangibly got out of engaging with the architecture team.
And I suppose understanding the wider business around how it does business, what the product is or what the service is, what geographic locations, who's the target market, where the revenue source is coming from. Because, you know, the person that comes to you with the idea of we want to buy this off the shelf product or piece of software so we can plug it into, you know, our team, et cetera, et cetera. But if it doesn't tie into the wider business, an architect is the perfect person to say, well, actually, have you considered this? Have you considered this? How does that tie into, you know, what we're doing out in the States? It doesn't, because, you know, it doesn't work over there or whatever it may be. So,
yes, I mean, I sometimes in reflective moments point out that the role of an IT architect probably isn't analogous to a building architect who's building just one building.
Yep.
It's probably more like a town and country plan. You're thinking not just the building that you're thinking of how it relates to the other buildings around it, what the connection points are, like roads, it might be passageways, might be connection points. It might be just how it aesthetically looks and in business terms, you know, how seamless it feels in moving from one application to another. Do I feel like I'm swiveling my chair from one screen to another, or is there a seamless handover of data happening there? So I think the role of the architect is envisaging all of that. And there are many layers to that. I think you rightly picked up on the matters of geography, particularly when you're talking about the shape of a business and where it's earning its revenue from.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, interesting. But, and I suppose, you know, over the past sort of 6 years, we've seen a rise in engineers becoming architects for a number of reasons. Some don't want to manage teams, so they see architecture as a route to still be involved in making decisions around technology, but not having to manage. And that's, you know, that's been helped with the rise of SaaS businesses and businesses calling themselves technology businesses and becoming more sort of product focused. Do you think that worked bearing in mind of everything we've spoken about the wider business, about, you know, the type of personality profile, asking the right questions? Do you think that engineers, and, you know, without tarnishing every single software engineer with the same brush, by the way, but can grow into architects?
I think engineers and architects occupy a similar space. I mean, engineers are probably more focused on the delivery and the sort of tangible deliverables. Architecture is a bit more conceptual, but I think there's a real blurring between those two roles, just as there's been a blurring down the years, down the last decade, certainly, between operations and development and the concept of DevOps. And so I don't think we need to be too hung up on particular titles. I've seen people I've promoted from developers into solution architects, you know, work very well in that. Likewise, we worked with engineers who had a great concept of design thinking and would make very talented architects. So I think there's certainly a sort of overlapping Venn diagrams of competence there. Yeah.
Okay. And without giving too much away, because people are going to have to wait for this to pop on LinkedIn, aren't they? But your new role is head of product architecture. We won't say who it's with, but that's really interesting. And I'd like to know, or we'd like to know a little bit more about whether or not, well, what the role entails, you know, at a really high level, but also whether or not you see that role growing legs in the future as we move, or as we have been in more product focused world.
Yeah, I mean, it's my first gig as a product architect, so it would be interesting to see how that pans out, and we'll discuss it shortly. But I mean, my vision for it is that it's taking the standard thinking that we are used to in the world of architecture and applying that across multiple product sets. And product does break it down. The concept of doing something as a product, it envisages a life cycle to that, something you continually invest in and you're evolving and you're developing a roadmap for. Now, there's clearly some sense when you've got multiple products in having roadmaps that span each of those and making sure that there's things that you can reuse between those different product sets. There'll also be capabilities which are very specific to the individual product capabilities. In my most recent role, so my time back with Lookers as the automotive retailer, had products that covered the web and the engagement. We had products that covered stock and the management of stock. And we had products that covered the management of customer data. So some quite different concepts. Nonetheless, there were some reusable capabilities that we could take across those, whether it is the web technologies that we used to front it, whether it's the underlying plumbing and the use of things like Azure Service Bus and the transfer of information between them, or indeed whether it's the database technologies that we have. So there are definitely things that you can reuse across there. So as a head of product architecture, I'd be very keen to make sure that we can get that commonality. And we can also set achievable and ambitious roadmaps for where we're going to take the technology in the future.
So if product architectures across all of that then, and again, I'm trying not to get hung up on job titles. That's pretty much the whole estate. And, you know, look, because we're a big business.
Yeah, so in revenue terms, about $5 billion they would turn over in a year. In a good year, they might make $100 million. So that was the sort of high water mark. But they worked hard for the money they made.
So, right. Yeah.
It was a big turnover, so really important to have a finger on the pulse of the information of the financials and make sure that we were making the most out of every pound.
Most out of it. You're responsible for everything over there, as you said. You know, the retail side, the database, everything across the whole architecture spectrum. So how does that differ to, you know, head of product architecture, or do you think it's just because it's a bigger organization? There's more to do.
Well, I'd say the distinction between my most recent role as head of enterprise architecture and head of product architecture is probably that focus on product and the focus on very specific method of investing in a technology domain, project approach of investing in something, put it in, sweat it, hope it's of use to you beyond the time over which you're depreciating that. Is probably not suited to most technologies these days because most technologies need to be evolved.
Yeah.
They need to be protected against any security threats that emerge and the underlying platforms that might have problems in them. They also need to be flexible to the business experiences out there. The market will change. We know the market change. And even leaving aside the sort of black swan events of COVID or war in Ukraine or anything else, new things will emerge. So it's important that our products are able to emerge. And that's why a traditional product to put something in and sweat it for 25 years just isn't going to work in most IT technologies.
And that's partly the problem with why, you know, I was reading an article, can't remember, back in the last year. I think it was a Gartner one, actually. And something astounding, like 82% of digital transformations fail. And fail is a really strong word, but effectively don't achieve the objectives they set out to. And that's one of the reasons why I set up this podcast, was to try and educate people and share war wounds and try and encourage people not to make the same mistakes other businesses have. But one of the reasons is because the longevity of that transformation program is so long, it might be 5-6 years, technology changes time and time again in those 5-6 years. So actually, yeah, the objectives are going to change. So I suppose it's finding a way where, you know, yes, we've got this big, you know, hairy, audacious goal, so to speak, but actually the smaller 3-6 month objectives that we're hitting, that we're moving into, you know, more success, I suppose, and allows us to.
Yes. I mean, I think that's important. I think people's expectations around delivery of IT projects, that they are increasingly intolerant of waiting 2 years for the enormo project to deliver or the enormo product to deliver. And you know, all right, well, we won't do anything for 2 years. We'll wait for that to happen. People aren't tolerant of doing that as perhaps they might have been some years ago. So I think the answer to that is perhaps to break it down into, well, what are the discrete components that we can deliver? What are the capabilities that we can deliver? And start to bring those up. And in the process, develop and demonstrate the value that you're going to get this particular approach. Now, not every digital transformation does that, and sometimes for good reasons, because seemingly the sort of boundaries of the problem are quite broad. They might have an entire business capability rather than a discrete piece of business logic. So I think the challenge to all of us is to think, well, how can we break this down into those bite-sized chunks and deliver them? and how can we make that happen? Without it seeming like it's, you know, something we've always got under construction over everything.
Yeah.
It feels like a building site for 2 years. So it's a fine balance. I think the other reason why digital transformations fail is because not every viewpoint was listened to. Back to the point about stakeholders. Business stakeholders are really important. So listening to what people want and making sure that you continue to design for what people are wanting. Having the courage to say, I know you said you want that, but you know, you don't want, this isn't the most important thing. And having that debate and making sure everybody's on the same page is also important. So you can't deliver everything. So make sure that you've had that conversation, you've had the discussions, people have reflected on it, maybe they've grieved on the fact it won't be getting the first iteration, and they understand what they're going to be getting when it is released. I think the other thing that's really important to do, and this is a role that architects can play in this, making sure that the technology voices are listened to. Too often in digital transformations, people are saying from a technology point of view, it'll never work, or it's going to hit this roadblock, or it's going to hit that roadblock. And they are swept up in the wider organizational desire to make change happen. So as an architect, it's important if you've got, whether it's an engineer or an analyst or somebody who has their doubts and is expressing those doubts, make sure you advocate for them, bring their doubts to the table, articulate for them respectfully, and you're not just throwing bricks at this. But bring those up and make sure that they are thoroughly understood by all the stakeholders, so that when you do hit problems in the future, you understand why you've hit those problems. This is a constraint you're working with.
Yeah. It's, as you said, it's managing downwards, upwards, and sidewards as well, depending on your stakeholders, and it's almost playing the middleman effectively, but doing it really, really well, whereby everybody's heard. Everybody's viewpoints are heard, but also challenged at the same time to make sure that actually what is the common goal, we'll work on it together. And we've just got to accept that actually, yes, you want that, but that if we do that, that then knocks out everything else. And ultimately, we're going to have to pay for that somewhere.
Yes. I think, you know, that middleman analogy is not a bad one. I think, you know, when we talk about with the position of architecture, people go into architecture, I think you said a couple of minutes ago, because they want to progress technically, but they don't necessarily want to step up to all of the people management capabilities. I mean, I've actually worked with architects who have a good understanding and empathy for people, and so work well with them, but because they don't have necessarily the drive or the determination that they want, that, you know, I want to manage people, they back off from purely people management skills. And in many ways, the fact that they are not pushing themselves forwards to be people managers makes them absolutely ideal to manage people's expectations and have those conversations.
Yeah. As long as they develop those people skills, you know, sometimes people don't want to manage other people because they're not good with people, or they don't want the aggravation. They're not good at dealing with conflicting conversations, difficult conversations.
No.
Sorry, what did you say?
So you wouldn't want to force somebody into a people manager.
No, of course not. Yeah, exactly that. And another point, which has been, you know, I speak to a lot of architecture leaders and they love to try and figure this out. But historically, again, architecture kind of been waterfall based in terms of, right, if we're going to build this, we need this to then do this. You know, we can't go to C until we've done A and B and so on and so forth. But in an architecture world, in an agile world, that's really difficult for an architect to be able to manage that, right? You know, some people have coined Wagile as a phrase, but I suppose, tell us a little bit about how you manage that and what your thoughts are on that.
So cards on the table time. Since I hit the job market in the 90s, I'm very much embedded in the waterfall mindset. So that's my background, but I think it depends what you're doing. If you're building a data center, then, you know, it's going to be really important that you do one thing before you do the other. You're going to want to do the survey. You're going to make sure the service is onto site. You're going to want to make sure that, you know, you're building the physical fabric, the supports of the data center before you're bringing in the electricals and the IT elements of it. So one thing does indeed have to happen after another if you're doing something on that sort of scale. So waterfall lends itself well to it. And of course, has its background in, you know, things like moonshot and other things. If we look at, you know, some of the other technology initiatives we might be doing, something that's responding to something that's emerged very quickly in the market. It's really engage with our customers quickly. We get something out there. We're not absolutely certain what we're getting out there. Perhaps it's going to evolve. Perhaps as customers work with it, we're going to evolve it a bit more. It lends itself to a different mindset, and an agile with a small A mindset is definitely what needs to come to it. And so agile with a capital A as a process, the agile process, managing something and doing it through, you know, a series of sprints, that's probably more appropriate to the delivery. Recognizing that you're getting out, you know, the first minimum viable product won't necessarily be all singing, all dancing, and will then evolve. And it's important what the role the architect can play in that is bringing the same design thinking into that and thinking about, well, what's the design, but how will it evolve and how will that change and what will be the connection points and how will we make the wider estate as we roll this out. So it is important that the architect's design thinking, the lengthy time frames that architects tend to think in, you know, the golden planning horizon, all of those thinkings must be brought into the process of an agile initiative just to show these
away. Okay, fair enough. And your career, Chris, has been, you know, there's been a number of occasions, and, you know, we've worked together for years, but there's been a number of occasions where you've gone in and you've set stuff up, whether that was at Cousins, who, you know, you covered. In fact, you tell us where it all started around going in, setting stuff up, moving on, going into the next place, setting stuff up. So, yeah, you tell us a little bit about that and we can sort of...
Yeah, well, I mean, 50 years at Hines through a number of different technology roles, ultimately leading onto architecture is probably the starting point. But I then tried my hand with Wipro, the big Indian outsourcer, for a couple of years, and some interesting work there. What it really persuaded me was that I wasn't keen on the sort of, if you like, the commercial confrontation that often comes from bidding and trying to win work. I was much happier building relationships up with the client companies and people within those companies. So that led me back into the world of working inside of an end user company. Working with the Royal Bank of Scotland on their stand-up of the Williams & Glyn Challenge Bank. And in that role, I was lucky to be able to play a part and to be instrumental in setting up the solution architecture practice. So we were looking at how can we make sure that we've got the right solution architecture governance that's a fit for a bank, because it's subject to certain regulations and restrictions. And taking on board from colleagues who've done this for quite some time in Royal Bank of Scotland, what would be the appropriate structures, but also trying to make it as light touch as possible. Also working out where the touch points would be, for example, with the technology front door, with new ideas that are coming into this. So that established essentially, in my mind, my own structures, my own framework, which I could then take on to the next gig, which in this case was Cousins.
Yeah.
They were already architects in PZ Cousins, just brought in some of the architecture governance that we made use of the Glyn and embedded that, and then took that on and slight change of role from the purely solution architecture role into enterprise architecture in Lookers. And again, you know, architecture was not an alien concept to Lookers. It had people who were called architects. It just had to draw all up together and had somebody thinking in terms of how do we make this work? What's the approach we take to whether we buy or build a piece of technology? What's the approach we take in terms of how we align with the technology front door, the business relationships and all of that? And how do we move that on and work with the project team? So, yeah, I mean, I've brought in some skills that I've learned in a number of different industries and made them work and kept the best of them, but always with an idea that, you know, some of that none of them are holy cows that, you know, sacred cows that must be kept and preserved against all things. It's what's fit for the organization you're working in. That's the
important. When you do go in then, yes, obviously what's fit right for the organization, but what are the first sort of things that you try to accomplish when you're setting up or bringing in together a true architecture practice rather than being architects being dotted around the business?
Well, I think start what you have and what the governance forums you have, whether it's already established architecture team meetings, or whether it's established project governance, work out what the sensible connection points would be to those. Focus on the things that you care about. So the important thing for me is that architecture is a two-pass thing at least. There's always that t-shirt sizing, that initial scoping, shaping of demand. And then there's a need, if the initiative has legs and there's a momentum behind it, to get into the high-level design. Depending on the nature of the piece of demand, you may then want to go into levels of low-level design and the like. And those are less important from an architecture, pure architecture governance, but making sure that what your deliverables are then useful for somebody else who's going on potentially building this against a recipe for the particular design. So just defining the artifacts, and again, not being less is more. It's important to focus on some of the key ones. For me, an impact assessment and a high-level design are the real anchor points for architecture. The other thing that's really an anchor point for architecture is diagrams. You can't be an architect without diagrams. So understanding what already exists, looking at that, again, applying that sort of very logical approach, work it through, explain it to me, what happens if this does that? Why is that there? What was the rationale for that? And when people articulate those, you get some really quite interesting conversations coming out of them.
Yeah. And on the whole governance piece, you know, the rise of shadow IT, departments or other stakeholders going off and doing what they want. And it's a nightmare for technology, or for the IT team, but more so for the architect, because that's just another problem that they've got to sort of integrate into the technology stack. So how do you put in a governance process to the wider business, without it seeming like a governance process, if that makes sense?
Well, I mean, I think it's making sure that people understand that why you're doing this, what's the value that architecture delivers. It can shape, it can inform, it can direct the demand and make realize a better outcome as a result of that. So articulating that to stakeholders is really important. Also, you know, the way I pitch it is, our architecture review board is always that we're more the repair shop than we are Dragon's Den. We're not there to fold our arms and say no to stuff. We would like to make things happen, but we want to make sure that we're forming it up and making it work. So that's my approach.
Yeah. Okay. And that's probably time. You need time to consider the technology that they're bringing to the table. But you mentioned a really, really good point. You know, I've always been on the sales side of things, and I've always, or have worked, sorry, for large businesses that, you know, do have a bit of a governance process. And you before you go and buy a piece of technology or whatever it may be, you've got to speak to the IT team. And I suppose you mentioned having a good tech front door. What does that mean?
Well, it can mean anything, and it wouldn't be prescriptive around job titles. I've seen sometimes the business analysis team are there. Sometimes it's people called IT business partners or business relationship managers. Don't get hung up on title, but it's important that everybody in the business knows where they're going to go when they're wanting to ask something of IT, particularly if they're asking something new. So service desk is obviously a really good point when you're wanting to order a new computer, or you're wanting to get a new user account set up, or the like. But it's important that somebody knows where to go with their request for, I want this new piece of software.
Yeah.
And how is it going to get evaluated? I think it's also important you demonstrate, you know, a consistency of approach. So it's not just about, you know, the right people knowing which buttons to press or which levers to pull. It's around consistently being somewhere where people can come to, you can assess that, you can fit it in around the wider demand stack and you know, get that duly prioritized and worked on.
Yeah, and I suppose when you do have that time to consider it, it's then you're able to prioritize it accordingly. But there's also a lot of things which, you know, the IT team and architects in particular get bogged down with, you know, small business change. How do you get small business change to work? You know, ones that don't necessarily contribute to the wider transformation program, but actually is really important to that department or that team.
Well, I think it's important that it gets prioritized, and if it needs initiative, that IT resource to be working on it, that it's, you know, it's inappropriately reflected. So what we don't want to do is derail people with everything being side of debt. There are instances, though, where, you know, the approach to use of IT is something that the best contribution IT can do is get out of the way. An example through my most recent engagement, there was somebody who wanted to use a particular piece of functionality from Monday.com. Won't name the end user department, but they were really keen to make use of this. We did some initial investigations from an IT point of view to make sure that it wasn't, you know, going against, for example, what we were doing with Salesforce or what we were doing with forms of engagement, and making sure that we understood how it fit with our wider tech estate. It was very clear there was a defined piece of work, a defined set of data that was held on there. Didn't include, for example, personally identifiable information, which helps enormously to the way. And it was clear that the best thing to do was to say, okay, get on, crack on, make use of that. Keep us informed. We'd be very keen to see how you're using it. And if you ever have a need for it to interface with other things in the wider IT world, then do get in touch. We will be in conversations with you then. And, you know, at that point, we might be thinking, is this the right tool or are there other tools within our tool set?
Okay. Brilliant. Now, over the past sort of 12 months, and, you know, we thought we were out the back end of it, but it seems to still be continuing and always in the news, but layoffs and redundancy. Now, you, and I hope you don't mind me talk about this, but at RBS, you experienced, you know, a huge round of redundancies, and more recently you have as well. I think it'd be really valuable and useful to sort of draw on some experiences on how you can deal with, you know, the unfortunate situation of if you have, or if somebody in your team has been made redundant.
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing to say is, and, you know, for everybody's information, I was made redundant by Royal Bank of Scotland, but they stood down the project that they were working on, the stand-up of Williams & Glynn's General Ledger Bank. And I've been made redundant from Lookers as a result of commercial pressures in the business and the need to radically reduce the cost base. Those things happen, unfortunately, and there's very little an individual can do to influence those. And, you know, I knew at the time there was very little I could do. Looking back, there's nothing I could do to change those. So yes, it's headwinds that you're vulnerable to. The really important thing to do is recognize that, you know, this is not a commentary on or a reflection on your own conduct or on your own capabilities. So have the confidence and have the courage to realize that you are just as good a person as you were before the redundancy notice came through. The second thing, and I think the thing that worked for me in both instances, was very quickly pivoting to, right, so my job now is to find another role and to work out where I want to go. And it's not just to take the first role, but it's to apply your usual levels of analysis and scrutiny to what's out in the market, what your capabilities are, what you enjoy doing, where you want to work. And so that could where in terms of sector, but it could be where you want to work. And indeed, how you work best, whether that is hybrid or remote or on-site roles. And so be fussy and you know, make sure that the applications that you're making are to places that you genuinely want to work. Because then when it comes across in interviews, you can genuinely, hand on heart, say, I'm really enthusiastic about this role. I would really like to work for this company. And then get that enthusiasm coming through in interviews. So that's what I would say. The other thing that I found useful in both occasions was to fall back on perhaps some of the skills that you enjoy using. And have yourself a little project whilst you're doing this, particularly if you find yourself with more free time as a result of either the consultancy process, as a result of actually being unemployed for any period of time. If you find that, it's useful to have a project in mind, a technology project, for example, but it could be anything. And use those skills. And nothing succeeds like success, I think they say. So being able to demonstrate to yourself, look, I've still got it. Look, this is what I've done. So in my most recent one, I took Salesforce, I adapted it to put all my job search and job opportunities and the status of them and the remuneration in there, for example, the employees' pension contributions. I'm not any picking, so I was particularly interested in how much the employer was going to be paying in as you can all get all of that lined up and played back to you. So a little bit of Salesforce knowledge that sort of picks up in the recent role, played back into something very personal. And having been setting them up makes you feel like you're achieving something.
Yeah, absolutely. You never know when you're going to get that free time again. So yeah, makes absolute sense. Great stuff. Brilliant. But we're going to go on to our quick fire questions now. So first one, what do you expect in 2024 will be a game changer from a technology perspective?
I think it's almost a stock answer that it's generative AI. But I think the whole world around both generative AI and machine learning have got a lot more to deliver. So those will probably be the big technology item for 2024. The other thing I would say for 2024 is expect the unexpected, which is only what we've learned really over the last decade or more. So I think the part technology plays is the ability to be quite fleet of foot and quite quickly change and pivot as the unexpected happens. So whether it's changes to commercial or economic circumstances, or whether it's geopolitical events, just expect the unexpected and be ready to pivot.
Fair enough. What advice would you give to a newly appointed chief architect?
I think get out there, have conversations, not just with the technology team, but that is really important, but get out and have some conversations with the wider business, with the people who, you know, have their hands on the purse strings or are earning the money or are doing the dirty work. Understand, you know, the nature of the business you're in.
Very good. Any advice you wish you'd received early on in your career?
Very much along the same lines as what I just said. Wish I'd got out of the office. Wish I'd got out onto the shop floor more, spoken with people more. That's really important because it really informs everything you're doing.
Brilliant. Okay. What's the hardest interview question you've ever had?
Well, one of the ones that I thought was the easiest interview question I ever had, and actually I answered really badly, was, what do your teams think of you? Because it was really easy to me. I just had feedback from one of my team members who just left to go to another gig. He said, you're a top bloke. So I replayed that at interview. But of course, what the interviewer was keen to understand is, well, why are you a top bloke? You know, is it that makes, what did you do? You know, and they were very keen to understand, well, you know, you listen to them, you help them grow, you help them with, you know, professional development. You were understanding when they wanted to go and seek new opportunities. You supported them. You looked at, you know, those sorts of things are the things that they were keen to get. So the best thing about any interview question, you know, show you working and work it out. So however difficult the interview questions are, I think Google famously asks you one where, how many gas stations or petrol stations are there in Manhattan? How do you do that? But the way you break it down is, well, how frequently do you see petrol stations? You know, you certainly don't. Few hundred yards, and how many are there likely to be in a built-up city like
Manhattan?
It's about a mile wide and about 10 miles long, so break it down and show you working.
Fair enough. Very good. What's the biggest change you expect to see in the market over the next 5 years, specifically from a talent perspective within architecture?
I think the increasing blurring between roles and lines. I think we will see for example, the increasing use of resources that need both developmental, so that is coding skills, and infrastructure skills. And we're seeing that obviously in the cloud offerings, where it's now not just a question of handcrafting virtual machines, but being able to have infrastructure as code can reuse. I think the ability to, for example, engineer prompts, whether for artificial intelligence capabilities or other things, or asking questions of data, those will all become more important than they already are.
Okay, brilliant. Oh, sadly, Chris, we ran out of time. I wanted to personally thank you so much for an excellent podcast episode. It's been really interesting. Great to chat with you about how connecting architecture to the wider business, and given your new role, and we'll all wait to hear it on LinkedIn, but I want to wish you all the best with that, mate. I know you will do everything perfectly, as you have done in your previous role since we've got to know each other.
Thank you very much, Barry.
And that's a wrap. Sadly, we're at the end of another Transformational Blueprints episode. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it and there were plenty of golden nuggets for you to take away. If you're a fan of the show, please do remember to share, like, and leave reviews so that more people from our industry get to hear and benefit from these too. Please also follow Synaptic Group on LinkedIn to keep up to date with new episodes. Links in the show notes. Join us next time for another episode packed with tips and advice from senior leaders in the technology world.